yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Sing the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, lots happening in the global economy, but how can we not talk about Trump and Trump's economics, if there is such a thing? Well, certainly, free trade. Trade is an issue, and taxes are an issue he's brought up. You know, on the tax front, he had promised during his primary campaign to cut taxes by $10 trillion. $10 trillion. But he's already switching on that. He's got his advisors working with the rest of the Republican Party bigs, and they're going to come out and change that because, you know, $10 trillion, what does that do to the deficit? Well, blows a big hole in it. You know, $19 trillion indebtedness, U.S. federal government debt, $10 trillion more, you know, that would be $29 trillion. Well, that kind of flies in the face of traditional Republican positions, doesn't it, about reduce the debt and so forth. And part of his coming to terms with Paul Ryan and all the other insiders in the Republican Party is to adjust that. So we're going to see some adjustment on that. Because if they don't, that big a tax cut, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, reduces federal revenue, tax revenue, from 18% of GDP to 14%, the lowest in the post-war period. And it's part of this long-standing, multi-decade development of removing taxes from investors and corporations. Yeah. You know, if you look at the deficit, U.S. deficit and the debt, you think, oh, it's all this excess spending and so on and so forth. Well, yeah, there's been some excess spending going on because the economy has not been growing very well, and we've been giving all these subsidies to corporations. But most of the government, federal government debt and deficit is due to the tax cuts that have been occurring and accelerating, and tax cuts going to investors and corporations, businesses. You know, under George Bush, what, $3.4 trillion in tax cuts? Under Obama, his first 2 years, you know, extending the Bush tax cuts, you know, another $500 billion, $250 billion every year. And then Obama in 2013 agrees to the fiscal cliff solution and pretty much bakes in the Bush tax cuts for another decade, costing another $4 to $5 trillion. So far, from Bush through Obama, we've given corporations and investors $10 trillion plus in tax cuts. And you know, they say, well, tax cuts create jobs. Well, the reality is, this proved that one, hasn't it? So we have this problem of massive tax cutting continuing going on, but mostly targeting business and investors. And the Tax Policy Center, commenting on Trump's tax policy program, has indicated that over 50% of the tax cuts will go to the top 5% of earners. No, these are the investors, you see. Corporate income tax gets slashed, and the personal income tax for investors, top end, you know, carried interest and all that kind of stuff, dividends, etc., they're the ones who benefit from it. There's been this rewriting of the budget going on for almost 20 years now that has just redirected the money to investors. And they say we have a deficit in the debt. Yeah, well, that's why. Just close the reverse the taxation problem, and you've solved the government deficit and debt, but you won't see that coming out of Trump. You'll see a traditional Republican position on taxes and debt. You know, maybe it won't be $10 trillion, but it will be a significant multi-trillion continuing going to investors and businesses and not much to anybody else. That's been going on, as I said, for at least two decades now. Actually, it goes back to Reagan, but it's been accelerating in recent decades since Bush and under Obama. Hasn't changed that much at all. Obama is a real continuity, you know. When you talk about neoliberal policies, you know, he's right in there, continuity. That neoliberal revolution began with, in the late 70s, with Reagan, and actually Jimmy Carter fell in line in his last 2 years with that whole plan as well. And that's continuing here. Well, that's the tax and deficit debt program of Trump. But what's getting all the attention, of course, is Trump's position on free trade, right? That's the one that really gets the attention. And that's contrary, his position, at least his stated position, is contrary to traditional Republican policies regarding free trade. And, you know, U.S. business elites are kind of nervous about Trump's views on free trade. I predict, however, Trump's going to change those views on free trade, certainly after the election. I think he's just pandering to the working class and discontent over free trade. And I've said so in a recent article published, Trump Trade and Working Class Discontent. You can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or if you want, you can go to its publication, and Telesur Media, South American progressive conglomerate media network, Telesur, out of Quito, Ecuador. Okay, so Trump trade and working class discontent. Let me talk about that a little bit before we get back to Trump's speech, because that's what we really want to look at. What does it really mean? How much can you believe? And what does it really mean? And is it going to get him elected? Well, we're going to see. We'll talk about elections and swing states and so forth, because he definitely has a shot at it. Particularly if, as we expect today or tomorrow, you know, Hillary Clinton is going to announce her vice president candidate. And it's almost certainly going to be Tim Kaine, another free trader. Yeah, another free trader out of Virginia, governor of Virginia, or senator of Virginia, I think. And big free trader, you know, which you got to take with a grain of salt. Heard her vacillations on this whole question of free trade, you know, forced by Sanders. I don't believe she will change anything on free trade. Once she's elected, she'll push forward with TPP. By the way, watch for TPP being voted on right after the election in the U.S. Senate. Depending on who doesn't get elected and who is elected, those who were opposed to TPP, where if they don't get elected, they'll just throw their vote for it and then go work for one of those companies with big pay. Anyway, if you listen to U.S. elites, they're very nervous about Trump and free trade. Let's presume he means what he says, Trump on free trade. We'll talk about that some more, but just some quotes here. The Business Roundtable's CEO, John Engler, right, in an interview. Now, what's the Business Roundtable? Business Roundtable is the biggest, most important, influential multinational corporation lobbying group in the U.S., the Business Roundtable. It's the lobbying arm of the Business Council, which is the most preeminent business organization. Business advocate organization, more important than Chamber of Commerce. In any event, what did Engler have to say? The Business Roundtable, quote, oh, there's a great sense of frustration here in the Roundtable. Trump's views are diametrically opposite of ours, and they are a cause of great concern. Yeah, and then Penny Pritzker, who's Penny Pritzker? Well, she's the current U.S. Commerce Secretary, Chicago billionaire, and head of the Chicago business mafia, right? And handpicked, by the way, our current president, Barack Obama, picked him out of South Chicago, pushed him to one term in the Illinois House of Representatives or Assembly, I'm not sure what they call it over there, and then plucked him out and pushed him and became the senator and before of Illinois and before that was over, pulled him out of that and pushed him for president. And we know the rest of the story, right? And, of course, we know that Barack Obama is the biggest free trader in the world, in the U.S. presidential history, the biggest free trader. And free trade, of course, is at the heart of neoliberal policy. You know, it's not just cut social spending and drive down wages and all the rest of that stuff, cut taxes for businesses and et cetera. That's all neoliberal policies began in the late 70s, early 80s, and they've been intensifying ever since. It's all about shifting income from non-business classes to business class. That's what neoliberalism is all about, right? But Penny Pritzker came out, and she also stated, oh, free trade, you know, very important. And so do mouthpieces for free trade in the liberal press, like Paul Krugman, Thomas Friedman, and all those. Even Christine Lagarde, the director of Washington-based International Monetary Fund, chimed in and called Trump's policies on free trade disastrous for the world economy. And then right before convention here, Republicans, you know, the three NAFTA presidents from Canada, U.S., and Nieto there from Mexico get together at a NAFTA summit, and they all come out, and they're talking about, you know, the problems of Trump-like trade protectionism and so on and so forth, right? So there's this circle of wagons going on among the business elite and their political friends to try to counter this argument of Trump attacking free trade agreements like NAFTA and preferred nation trading rights, proto-free trade for China, and TPP and TTIP in Europe and all that stuff, right? Yeah. So that's really what we see going on behind the scenes. The business class is trying to rally its spokespersons and its pundits and so forth to counter free trade position of Trump, right? And we're going to see a lot more of that, a lot more defense of free trade. Well, what is free trade? Let me just make a few comments on that. And that's this false academic theory that everybody benefits from free trade. Both sides will benefit. You know, they call that comparative advantage. I'm not even going to go into the nonsense because it's a theory that's based upon two, maybe four countries at the most trading. And you can, you know, economically show how if each produces and exports and sells, you know, it's the products that it has the most advantage in producing, that everybody will benefit, and total production will go up everywhere, and it'll lift all boats. Free trade lifts all boats. That's the academic argument, right? But the problem, the big problem with that argument is it countries don't trade. Businesses trade. Right? And over half of the trade in the world, at least U.S. trade, is intra-company trade. Intra, you know, I mean, it's like GM goes builds, Ford, GM goes and builds parts, engines, auto engines in Brazil and sends them back to the United States, right? That's considered free trade. A lot of the free trade and trade deficit we have are U.S. companies that have relocated offshore, and they're just sending the stuff back, you see. And it's intra A lot of the trade is, you know, within a company, not between companies, first of all. But the theory is about nations trading. But the real problem with free trade theory is that it says nothing about who benefits within each of those countries. You might be able to logically show, if you only talk about four countries, how the production increases in all, and more GDP in all because of free trade, but who gets it within those countries? Who gets the benefits of that? To whom is the wealth distributed within each country? Right? Well, it goes to corporations, investors, and shareholders. It doesn't go to wage earners. You can have this situation where two countries trading, their production goes up, and their investors and businesses both get richer because of it, but the wage earners in both countries get worse. You see, they don't talk about distribution, income distribution effects of free trade at all. Right? Corporations and investors would benefit on both ends of the trade exchange, but that's not the same as saying that the working classes benefit on both ends. Right? It ignores income distribution effects. In fact, most of mainstream economics ignores distribution effects, you see. It's all about production and businesses and growth and so forth and GDP, but doesn't say much on who benefits from all this. You know, the courses in distribution theory in academia are far and few between. Not without purpose, you see. Right? But nonetheless, free trade is a holy grail of neoliberal economics, right? But it's wrong. It's nonsense. If you look at working class incomes and jobs, if you lose jobs, of course, you lose incomes. The U.S. has lost 6 million manufacturing jobs in the last 15 years, 6 million. Perhaps at least two-thirds of that due to free trade agreements, China, bilateral, NAFTA, free trade deals. The number of jobs that are created because of increased U.S. exports is less than the number of jobs that are lost because of the impact of free trade on import-affected industries in the U.S. So net-net, we lose jobs, you see. And you can say the same about incomes, net-net. There's this what's called export-import wage differential. And you look at that, and you see that wages rising in those companies and industries benefiting from increased exports as a result of free trade, those wage increases are less than the wage declines in those industries and companies in the U.S. That are harmed by free trade. In other words, they lose jobs, they lose businesses. So wages falling more in the negative affected companies and industries than they are rising in the positive affected. So the net effect is a decline in wages and a decline in jobs. Right? But free trade is also about money and investment flows. You know, you think of trade, you think of goods flows. You know, I'm going to produce Lexus cars and send them, you know, Japan send them to the U.S., and the U.S. is going to produce jumbo jets and sell them to, Australia, et cetera, right? It's also about money and investment flows. In fact, it's mostly about money and investment flows as far as the U.S. is concerned. Read the NAFTA agreement, and there's far more detail about conditions allowing U.S. multinational companies to invest in Mexico, in other words, to move to Mexico. So free trade is not just about loss of jobs because of the trade effects. It's also about loss of jobs because of the money flows and therefore job offshoring, right? So you lose jobs and you reduce income because of export-import differentials, but you also lose jobs and therefore income because of job offshoring, which has to do with relocating investment abroad. You know, here's an example. We used to have a company called Delphi, which is a major auto supplier in the U.S. Delphi Auto. Well, Delphi closed its 20 factories in the U.S. and moved them to Mexico. Delphi employs 100,000 workers in Mexico now, and they just shipped that same stuff right across the border, tariff-free. Right? How about this company, Dell Computer, right, in Texas, Dell Computer, right, says, oh, our laptops and PCs are made in the U.S. No, they're not. They're made in Mexico. They bring them across the border. They slap a logo, a Dell logo on it, and they say made in America. Yeah? But all those, and you can multiply all of these examples. There's many examples, right? The combined effect of the job offshoring and loss of higher paid manufacturing jobs, so forth, and not just manufacturing, but professional services, communications, a lot of other industries now, not just pure manufacturing, are affected. But the result is U.S. household median wages have declined by 10% since 2000. Hmm? Well, workers are beginning to get smart. U.S. workers are beginning to understand this thing. And Trump is plugging into it, right? And they look around and, they say their jobs and their incomes disappearing because of these trade effects. And then they hear about how the wealthiest 1% of households have accrued 95% of all the net national income gains in the U.S. since Obama came to office. 95% has gone to the wealthiest 1% of all the gains. Now, to what extent the U.S. economy has grown, which has been relatively weak, but it has grown some since 2009, 95% of all the income generated from that economic growth has gone to the 1%. Well, people know that now. Well, they don't need to know all the details, but it seeps in after 7-8 years. And Trump is playing to that discontent. Trump is popular and leading in the polls in this important block of white, middle-aged, male, non-college-educated working-class voters. He's targeting states, where mining and steel and manufacturing have been devastated. And those states, a number of them happen to be swing states in a U.S. election cycle here. Now, he's targeting Ohio and West Virginia and Wisconsin and places like that. Smart. It's smart. Reagan did that with some success back after the crisis of the 1970s. It's called the Reagan working class vote, and Trump is repeating it with a vengeance, right? Trump has a further advantage, though, because he can leverage the fears and concerns about immigration, and he links that to the free trade issue and the decline of jobs and opportunities, not only for existing white working class voters and Hispanic voters too, but their children, the future. There's this terrible malaise in the country in which people are realizing that their kids are going to have it tougher. Right? That block is not only having problems itself as it approaches retirement, and it's increasingly fearful, what are we going to do in retirement? Because the retirement system is broken down in this country as well. Originally in the 50s, it was based upon it was called three-legged stool. One-third of your retirement income would come from Social Security. One-third would come from your company pension plan, a defined benefit pension where you were guaranteed when you retired so much per month for your service and your savings. Yeah. Well, they destroyed the pensions, defined benefit pensions. They stripped them and turned them over to the banks, and they call these 401k plans, and made you invest in stock. And when the stock market crashes, you lose it. $4 trillion were lost during the last crash. In 401ks and IRAs and stuff like that, right? They privatized the defined benefit pension system, so there's nothing there. So that stool is gone. And then no one's been able to save because of the wage decline and the loss of good jobs, and particularly youth. You know, whether they got part-time temp contracts, gig jobs, right? So that's another big block. The under 30 block, youth block, well, they've been leaning towards Sanders. Well, of course, Sanders threw in the towel like we knew he would. I've always supported Sanders' program, but I never trusted the fact that he would ultimately throw in back in with the Democratic Party. And, of course, he's done that, right? And that means the Party of Free Trade, you know, and other problems with the positions of that party as it's moved right in the last 30 years. It's moved into the corporate sphere even more than it was. Okay, so we have these voting blocks. You've got to understand, the white working class block and the youth block, right? And then we have a smaller African-American block and gays and Hispanics. And how these blocks vote in the swing states is what it's all about. You know, we have this archaic system in the U.S., defined by the Electoral College. And it doesn't matter what the popular vote for the president is. They've maintained this centuries-old system for checking in sort of like the last defense of the ruling elites if a result comes in an election where you have a radical change being promoted by a presidential candidate. These electors don't have to vote the way the people in their state vote. You know, as long as they're not needed, they go ahead and do that. But technically, they can vote for someone opposite. You could have a majority vote in the state, and electors could vote for someone else. And who are these electors? You know, how did they get appointed? Who are these? And no one knows. Big secret, right? Do you know who your electors are in your state? Or how they were appointed and what their backgrounds are? No, you don't. It's a big kept secret. Keep it under the covers just in case they got to use it. Well, to get back to the point here, it all depends upon the swing states and these key blocks that could go either way in the swing states. Now, Obama really pulled the Hispanic and the African-American and the youth vote and the women vote and the union vote, which used to be a very important block, but it's pretty much shrunk as the unions have all but almost disappeared. But it still has a little bit of influence in certain states. Right? These are the big blocks. How do they vote in those states is the question. The swing states I'm talking about. Well, we're going to see. But one thing we know is that in these swing states and certain of these blocks, Trump is really playing his violin. He's really singing to and talking to the rage that is far deeper than these elites understand among people who have been battered by the crash and the lack of recovery for them. You know, Obama sits back and says, oh, we got a recovery. Yeah, recovery for whom, you know? I predicted all that back in my 2012 book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. I predicted, based even on evidence up to 2011, that all this recovery was going to go to investors and the wealthy, and it wasn't going to trickle down. And that's exactly what's happened. And that's why people are discontent. You know, mainstream's been left behind. The investors and businesses have done well, you know, record corporate profits and record bond sales and bond profits and speculative profits, big tax cuts to allow them to keep most of that. So they've done well, you know, and if you look at GDP, it's not growing as fast as it was, but, 1.5 to 2%, about 60% of what is normal for U.S. recovery, but, 95% of that's gone to the 1%. So, you know, they did okay, but the rest haven't, and the rest are discontent. Right? We got massive discontent, deep discontent across all these blocks, these voting blocks. Certainly white, middle-aged, male, non-college-educated, working-class voters. And they're going to go for Trump because he's linked two things to their discontent. Whether it's true or not, he's linked free trade and immigration. Right? And that's resonating with those folks right now. That's why they don't care what the media, liberal media, and whatever media says about Trump. You know, all the intellectuals can rail all they want and talk about, you know, what a proto-fascist this guy Trump must be, but and really knock his extreme statements. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change their views, you see, because all they're thinking about is they've been abused, and they don't care what the political elites say or the media say anymore. They just want someone to shake it up. They're just angry, and it's not logical, you know, what's this policy for me, what's that policy for him, kind of an analysis that intellectuals might engage in. It's just anger, and they want someone to turn over the can. Okay, so that's what Trump is playing into. And what's his position on free trade or trade? Well, he says he's going to tear up NAFTA, the NAFTA treaty. That's what he said, tear it up. He's going to impose tariffs on imports from China to Mexico of 45%, 35%, respectively. He's going to stop China from manipulating currency. And he's going to build a fence for immigrants, keep the immigrants out. Okay, but I think this is all pandering. I don't think he intends to do any of this. This is just tapping into this discontent and fooling people again, because you can't believe what any of these candidates of the corporate party of America, there's two wings, Republican, Democrat, you can't believe what they say. You can't trust them. Americans tend to be too trusting. They take people for their word, right? If they're politicians and others. Oh, you say you're going to do this? Yeah. Well, just look at what Obama said he was going to do and what he eventually did. Nothing. Nothing. Really. Saved the banks. Okay. Restored capital incomes. Gave folks 14 million low-pay service temp jobs that are going to disappear in the next recession coming next year, I predict. Right? Kept the tax cut flow going to the rich. Right? Did nothing about immigration. In fact, he was the biggest exporter until he got reelected again. Biggest exporter of immigrants. In U.S. history, right? There's a block, by the way, that is a big question mark, and that's the Hispanics. You know, the Hispanics have been exploited by the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party hasn't done diddle for them. And I think they're going to remember that, and I think when it comes time to vote, they're going to stay home. And I think a lot of millennials and young workers and so forth is going to be the same thing, you know. They had this flicker of hope with Sanders, and, of course, you know, Sanders never had a chance, got manipulated by the Democratic Party, thought he was manipulating it. And in the end, what was inevitable was they swallowed him, right? And he even indicated he's going to support Hillary. Hmm? So that's what happens to the Sanders Revolution. Any real revolution's got to be independent of these two wings of the corporate party of America. You cannot reform it from the inside. You cannot even reform it from the margin, Sanders, from the inside, Elizabeth Warren. You can't. The corporate interests have a stranglehold on the Democratic Party. You're not going to change it. You have to replace it. And there has to be a real grassroots movement coming together and forming an independent party. Right. But let's look at these charges, or these proposals, by Trump. You know, I said he's pandering on the free trade issue, on the trade issue here, you know, saying, I'm going to tear up NAFTA, I'm going to impose tariffs on China and Mexico, I'm going to stop China from manipulating its currency, I'm going to build a fence. Okay. Well, what does he mean by tearing up? What does that mean, right? Presidents can't tear up treaties in the U.S. system. It's structured to prevent that. You know, once it's endorsed by the Senate, it's got to be renegotiated and revoted on by the U.S. Senate. You can't just change it. You know, tearing up. He's going to unilaterally, you know, on January 20, 2017, he's going to say it's null and void. Tear it up. Well, that's what tear up suggests. No, no, he can't do that. Well, what about unilaterally raising tariffs? This 35% and 45%. He can't do that either. Under the 1974 Trade Act, a president can raise tariffs no more than 15% for just 150 days. After that, it has to be congressional legislation. Well, what about Trump's claim that China is a currency manipulator? Well, that's the most factually incorrect of all of his proposals here. China is not a currency manipulator. China has pegged its currency to the dollar for over a decade now, and within a narrow range it gets to move, but as the dollar goes up, it goes up, and the dollar goes down, it goes down. So it can't manipulate its currency. It's not a manipulator if it's tied to the dollar, the yuan, the currency of China, tied to the dollar, pegged to the dollar, right? Oh, okay, so it fluctuates in a narrow trading band, but I mean it's very narrow, you know, like 6.2 to 6.6 yuan to the dollar. You know, you might move it to 6.5 or 6.3, but that's it. That's not manipulation. You want to know who the big currency manipulators are? Japan. Yeah, Japan has manipulated its currency, reduced it over the years, 20 to 30% reduced it to the dollar. Yeah, they're the big currency manipulator, and Europe, you know, 15 to 20%. They're the currency manipulators, but we don't hear anything about them, do we? And what does Trump have to say about all these hundreds of thousands of skilled workers coming in to the U.S. on H-1B and O-1 visas? Nothing. Nothing. You know, if you want to talk about job offshoring and doing something about that, well, now, what's your policy on visa imports? Now, these are high-paid tech jobs that Americans could take, but aren't, because the multinationals, because they're global, like to move their people around and bring them in here from Asia and you know, other places around the world and cycle them in for 4 or 5 years and then send them back out. Many of them stay. So nothing said about that. And what about the job offshoring, which he does talk about? He says he's going to stop job offshoring by multinationals, sending jobs offshore as investments go offshore instead of investments by these companies being conducted here in the United States. Well, what's he going to say? You know, what's his policy on that? Well, most important way to stop that is to stop the tax incentives for these companies to move offshore and start imposing tax penalties for investing abroad, forcing them to invest here in the U.S. Well, there's nothing in that in his tax policy, so I can only conclude he's not serious about job offshoring. No. Again, my conclusion is Trump is very clever. He's got his finger on the pulse of a major source of discontent in the U.S., and he's pandering to it, he's speaking to it, and he's focusing on trade as, you know, the core element of this economic policy, but I don't believe a word he says. Just as I don't believe a word that Hillary says about free trade. All right, so let's turn to Trump's speech yesterday. I listened to it in great detail, took, you know, a lot of notes on this thing, and what's he talking about? You got to realize that Trump is a real estate wheeler dealer. That's his mentality. He's a speculator. Yes, he builds real properties. But the real money is made on the financial assets that are based upon those real properties. And he won't reveal his tax cuts because you won't, his tax forms, because you won't see, or you would see, if he did reveal them, all the shady deals. You don't become a multimillionaire billionaire in the commercial real estate industry in the U.S. without being a fraud and a wheeler dealer and, you know, walking that fine line between what's legal and illegal and often what's illegal and back and forth. You just don't make money in commercial real estate or real estate in general without stretching the law. And I'm sure that's what he's done. And that's why he doesn't reveal that. See, he's a real estate wheeler dealer, and you can see it in his attitude when he speaks. You know, I watched him very closely, and he's got a different character compared to these other professional politicians. Right? He's a risk taker, and you got to be a risk taker in real estate, right? And he believes he can negotiate his way out. He thinks, you know, he's got a big ego, and he thinks he can negotiate America back to number one, as he says, right? He's going to sit down with ISIS. He's going to sit down with the Turks. He's going to sit down with the Russians and the Chinese, and he's going to wheel a deal here, right? Just like he would on some property in some big urban center in the U.S. He's too confident about his ability to negotiate, you know. He's an egoist, which is dangerous for someone in that position with that kind of power. A risk taker, a wheeler dealer, overconfident about his own negotiating ability, that's a formula for disaster. All right. And what has he done? He said... He's going to lead us to safety, prosperity, and peace. I am the law and order president. You cannot have economic recovery without law and order. Okay, so law and order comes before economic recovery. Going to crack down on law and order, and that will lead to recovery. And not that much talk about... you know, details of economic programs and policies in his speech, it was very much appealing to fear. Fear that American families do feel, you know. And it's not so much fear about immigration, although he's made that an issue. It's more fear about insecurity for them and their families and their futures. And we got to lay that blame on George Bush and Barack Obama. They've created that. You know, they are the. What we're seeing with Trump is the fruit of their policies and efforts. Right. We're in a moment of crisis, right? He says homicides are up 25%. In Chicago, 2,000 people have been killed in last year alone, 4,000 since 2009, a 50% increase in police killings. And then he says, after he says all this, then he says, and we have 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records. Oh, you know, association there. You know, all this police killing and so forth must be due to all the illegal immigrants. You know, he takes this logical leap. You know, in the economy, 4 out of 10 African children are in poverty, yes. 58% African-American youth are unemployed, yes. 2 million Latinos are more in poverty under Obama. 14 million have left the labor force, yes. Labor force participation rate, 14 million. Oh, we hear about the 14 million jobs that Obama's created, but we don't hear about the 14 million who have dropped out because they couldn't get jobs, or they felt that these low-paid minimum wage jobs weren't worth the effort, you see. You don't hear about the 14 million left the labor force. Right. $800 billion in trade deficits and the doubling of the national debt. Yes, all true. All true. Which gives him the ability to link poverty and economic, you know, lack of economic distribution to the violence. You see, that's what he's doing. He's taking the economic crisis and he's saying, oh, it's directly associated with the violence. You know, and the violence means, of course, the immigrants, right? He says he's going to make America first. And, quote, no prosperity without law and order. Says he's going to create new jobs, but it doesn't say how or where or with what. But he also appeals, you know, he also appeals to this working class discontent by referencing big business, elite media, and major donors lining up for Hillary. He doesn't need it because he's one of them. In the past, he's got his own money, but he's also now appealing to other big business lobbyists and so forth, right? But he says, oh, big business and elites and so forth, and Hillary's their puppet. They pull the strings. Well, he's one of the string pullers, you see. He's not a puppet to the billionaire class. He is part of it, so he doesn't need anyone to pull his strings. He pulls his own strings, right? And, but she's the puppet. Oh, but, you know, she's a pretty wealthy puppet, too. If you look at a recent article that was just published here in the Financial Times, I think it was, or maybe it was the Wall Street Journal, I'm not sure, talking about Hillary's money. Yeah, let's talk about Hillary's money. Yeah, it was today in the Financial Times, a big section, the big read, U.S. election, Clinton's money, right? And they lowball the money here. When Bill finished, Bill Clinton here, you know, finished office, you know, they maybe were worth a million or so, but now both of them are worth over $100 million. Hillary and her husband. A lot of it speaking fees for Hillary, right? Clinton was paid just this year, Bill Clinton, right? $500,000 by the Bank of America for one speech. $500,000. And Hillary was paid $450,000 to speak to two for-profit education companies in 2014. This is 2014. We don't even know what 15 and 16 is when the money really ramped up for them. Right? But Bill is getting a lot of money for speeches, and so is she. You know, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars out of whack. Well, no wonder they're worth $100 million each. Right? And the book publishing, you know, the publishers, they give either the Clintons big advances, million-dollar advances, and if they can't sell the books, then the corporations buy up the leftover stock for them. You see, that's how the money gets distributed to the political representatives of the economic elites, right? Yeah, well, definitely, Hillary is a puppet, right? Trump is one of the puppet pullers, string pullers. Beware of billionaires bearing gifts. Donald Trump. Okay. So we've got this program, if you can call it that, from Trump, right, of law and order first, and then some kind of economic program that will restore jobs and get rid of free trade somehow, or trade somehow. I mean, you know, the details are not there, and they're unimportant as far as he's concerned. And we're not going to hear details, right? And one thing I found interesting, too, in his speech was, you know, he kept punctuating everything he, not everything, but many things he said by, right now, quick, very soon, very, very fast, right after January 20, 2017, you know? As if he's going to immediately be able to deliver on any or all of this stuff. Because people are these blocks are very discontent and they want change now. So he's telling them, we're going to give it to you right now. Right? He even appealed to Sanders supporters on the free trade issue, you know. First task of his new administration, though, was safety. I am the law and order candidate, right? Well, you know, that's not unlike what Nixon said when he ran for office, law and order, after the chaos of the 60s, right? So he's picking up themes from past presidents that worked, themes from Reagan, you know, white working class, things from and distribution of income. You know, Reagan said in his debate there with Jimmy Carter, one of his debates in 1980, he says he looks at the television monitor and he looks at the American people and says, are you better off today after 4 years of Jimmy Carter? And that was it. I mean, the election was over, right? Watch Trump to say the same thing. Are you better off? And he's going to play that card. Well, you know, the Nixon law and order card, right? I'm going to deal with the communists. I'm going to China, you know, free trade, etc. A lot of similarities. But some differences, you know. He's going against the grain in the Republican Party on trade, on immigration, and even attacking elites. But it's working, you see. It's working. And, of course, you know, the same old pandering to the Jewish vote. You know, our greatest ally in the Middle East is Israel, as he says, right? And then, of course, the big threat is the immigration, which ties in ISIS and terrorists with immigrants in general, right? And we are going to build a great border wall, he says, to stop violence, gangs, and drugs, you see. Immigration and violence is associated with the two, right? The laws will be enforced on January 20th, 2017, and that Hillary has a radical policy to allow more lawless immigrants to come into the country. Now, he's going to reform the tax laws and energy and regulation. He's going to do it fast, you see. He's going to cut regulation costs by $2 trillion very, very quickly, quote. He says, very, very quickly. Oh, small businesses love that, right? He's going to restore U.S. energy production, which means let's go back and dig more coal, right? And more fracking and more oil and so forth. Well, you know, he's looking at Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio votes, working class votes where people are devastated. And then there's a number of other conservative talking points that have to be mentioned that he brought up here. School choice for U.S. children, right? He's going to repeal and replace Obamacare, right? He's going to do something about student debt, rebuilding the military. My God, we spent $1 trillion on the U.S. military. He's going to rebuild it? What does that mean? We're going to spend more? Right? I don't know. Sounds like it. You know, he talks about countries that have to pay their fair share for the U.S. military protection umbrellas, most notably NATO, right? You know, in the first 100 days, he's going to do something for U.S. veterans. He's got a 10-point plan. And this is all conservative hot buttons, right? They all like this. And then, of course, Clinton wants to abolish the Second Amendment. And he says, I'm endorsed by the National Rifle Association, that criminal organization, NRA. Right? And therefore appeals to that conservative bloc here. And he very sheepishly then said, the evangelicals and religious community, thank you for putting me in this position here. Without you, I couldn't have done it. And what I'm going to do is change the tax laws so that you get to be even more politically active as a nonprofit. Right. We're going to show the world that America is back, bigger, stronger, and better than ever before, right? And then he concludes with this show of, oh, he's such a family man, right? Talks about his father, right? It respects the dignity of work and working people. Talks about construction workers, right? That he's supposedly, when he's younger, sort of slummed around with and mixed with on the job and so forth, you know, and how, quote, I love these people. Bricklayers, carpenters, electricians, he says. Well, he's appealing to that white working class segment, you know, construction workers, appealing to mine workers and their families, and steel workers and their families, and all those families harmed by free trade and job offshoring, NAFTA, and so forth, right? Those 100,000 workers who used to work for Delphi now, you know, those folks, right? Right. History is watching us, he says, you know, and you know, you can't help thinking when you watch him on TV, right? You know, he at one point he turned and he looked left and he turned and he looked right, you know, and he got his chin up and he's got that smile, and I said, wow, who is this guy? Is this Donald Trumpolini? Right? He kind of struts around a little bit like Mussolini did. Oh, I'm not saying he's a fascist. He's not a fascist. You know, you don't need fascism in America. The ruling elites don't need fascists because they aren't really under attack. They like authoritarian people. They don't like democracy. They like authoritarian people who will more easily be influenced when they need to. But there's no fascism in America. Trump is not a fascist. People who say that don't understand what fascism really is. You know, there's no fascism because they don't need fascism. They got guys like Trump, and they got guys like Bush, who deliver the goods, you see. But he finishes up here, I'm with you, the American people. I am your voice. You know? And I will fight for you. Right? I make this promise. We will make America strong, proud, safe, and great again. I'm your boy in the White House, is what he's saying to them, to this white working class and other disaffected segments. And you know, as I said earlier, the election is all about swing states. What are the swing states? Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Virginia, Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe Colorado. Those are the swing states. We're talking about 7 or 8 states. That's all you have to win, because the rest are solidly Republican or solidly Democrat. And what he's doing is putting together a strategy that appeals to these disaffected segments, in these 7 states. Ohio, Florida, right? North Carolina, Virginia, etc. Who's got the bigger base, Republicans or Democrats? Who turns out more of that base, Republicans or Democrats, in those 7 states? That's what the election is all about. And it's beginning to look to me that he's certainly going to mobilize the disaffected groups that he's targeting, and I'm increasingly doubtful that Hillary is going to be able to mobilize her groups because of the legacy of Obama. I don't see Hispanics turning out for her the way they turned out for Obama, and they swung several key states. Right? Union folks are, you know, union heads may say we support him, but I don't know that the working class is going to come out and support her. Certainly youth that supported Sanders, a lot of them are disaffected. You know, can she scare them into a no vote against Trump for her? We'll see. But there's some real questions whether she can turn out her base, and it looks like he'll turn out his. Well, we'll see. Everything will be decided in the first TV debate. Okay, that's it. My take on Trump and the elections, and we'll talk again on Hillary after that convention, that circus. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.